Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Douglas. Have you ever heard that myth that mattresses double in weight every 10 years? It is true that mattresses can get kind of gross over time. Man, I was so tired of my old mattress. Until thankfully I got a new mattress. It has a moisture-wicking, machine-washable cover to keep things fresh. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress protector, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by AG1. In Shakespeare's England, if you were in your salad days, it meant that you were at the peak of your youth. I'm calling that my AG1 days. I drink AG1 every morning to stay at the top of my game. So if you want to take ownership of your health, it starts with AG1. Try AG1 now, and you'll get a free welcome kit that includes a shaker bottle, canister, and metal scoop, along with 5 free travel packs and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2, all with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/backbench. That's drinkag1.com/backbench. Hey, it's Matea Roach, and this is The Backbench, a podcast about Canadian politics and how to stop worrying and love the sound of trucks honking. Years ago, something big happened. Remember? The Freedom Convoy. If you, like me, have tried to memory hole the whole thing and just feel like you would rather forget about it, I don't really blame you. It sucked. We were international news for months, and honestly, it was all kind of embarrassing.
Well, Justin Trudeau, meanwhile, keeps tumbling from one crisis to the next.
Ottawa has been paralysed by truck drivers.
For 2 weeks now, these protesters have laid siege to this city.
Eventually, the trucks left, the honking stopped, and people went home. But not before Justin Trudeau invoked the Emergencies Act in response to the convoy, an act which was eventually found to have violated charter rights. The convoy brought a group of people together. They had different beliefs, backgrounds, and reasons for protesting, but they found a community.
It's a togetherness like I've never felt before.
That togetherness eventually ended when the police forcibly removed hundreds. Some organizers, such as Tamara Leach, Chris Barber, and Pat King, were charged and are nearing the end of their lengthy trials. Despite this, freedom enthusiasts have continued fighting for their causes of choice. And it's easy to gloss over or ignore just how much the convoy has shifted our political discourse, even 2 years on. I was surprised to learn from reporting from Luc Lebrun from Press Progress, various supporters of the convoy have become very politically engaged in causes like the 1 Million March for Children.
With supporters and opponents of the elimination of sexual orientation and gender identity lessons in schools.
The Save the Children convoy.
In this small southern Alberta town, pride has come under attack. Where a rainbow flag once flew stands only a jagged post.
Canadians for Truth, featuring Theo Fleury and Jamie Soleil, former sports stars.
Remember that when Putin attacked Ukraine? Mm-hmm. Theo Fleury's like, just got off the phone with Putin. Great guy.
Also protests at Drag Queen Story Hours and even a self-proclaimed grassroots lobby group, Take Back Alberta. But like, why? What do all these causes have to do with the 2022 convoy? From a movement that started out as videos on TikTok to raising millions of dollars, the movement didn't go away. And I, for one, think the 2022 Freedom Convoy has fundamentally changed the discourse.
The Prime Minister actually can't complete the stop and can't meet with the vendors and can't do what he's there to do because it's too dangerous. And that is the opposite of what we're trying to achieve as a democracy. And it's a whole.
I know I'll never see a truck with a Canadian flag in quite the same way.
Arrest the politicians, the corrupt WEF, the World Economic Forum.
So to unpack all of this, we have David Mosgrob, author and political theorist, and also recently Galen Weston impersonator. Hi, David.
That's right. That's right. I want a paternity test.
Next up, we have another David, David Fraser from the CBC, who's been reporting on the convoy and the trials surrounding it. Hi, David.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we've got two Davids on the podcast. So Mosgrob, you're now Mosgrob, and Fraser, you're now Fraser.
Deal.
For ease of everybody's understanding. Got it? Get it?
Sounds great.
Fantastic.
Let's get into it. So to start off, I want to sort of set the scene a little bit and go back to October of 2023, when a group of about 100 people camped out in a farm field about 40 minutes east of Ottawa for 3 weeks, plotting to replace Canada's government. They staged daily protests near Parliament Hill, resulting in several criminal charges and also someone getting tasered by police. This group called for the jailing of politicians and, you know, again, wanted to install a new government.
So what is wrong with putting these people in prison for the crimes that they've committed and setting a system in place that benefits the people, for the people? There's nothing wrong with that, and nobody will convince me otherwise.
Now, this was very loosely associated with the Freedom Convoy, but it was sort of a different beast called the Save the Children movement. So what exactly were these people protesting about and what the heck was going on? Because this is the sort of extremist political organizing that I think in Canada we like to pretend doesn't exist or doesn't happen.
So what's interesting about that movement was it was plainly in part inspired by the United States and by a new general development of disease with government in this country. And what's fascinating about it in relation to the convoy is that the concerns are amorphous and they are, let's say, flexible. Now, so it can be concerns about children, it could be concerns about gender politics, it can be concerns about vaccine mandates, it can be concerns about taxation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what it broadly indicates is that there's been a sort of groundswell in the movement of anti-government sentiment in this country. But even more importantly, the networking of that movement, which is something I think we should spend some time talking about as we go, because these folks have always existed. But the significant difference in recent years has been the extent to which they can reach one another, grow the movement, network the movement, coordinate the movement with the advent of technologies that most of us use every day.
And that's something that we saw coming out of the Freedom Convoy. It was a concern of authorities when everybody first was leaving Ottawa that there would be this new community, these networks of people that were created, and we're seeing that come into fruition. We know, for example, CSIS is reporting that threats against gender politics is increasing. They say that that's a growing concern. It's going to continue to be a growing concern. They point directly to the Freedom Convoy as a source for that. So it is a good point that we're going to continue to see more and more of this activity, I think.
I want to get more into later on sort of the nuts and bolts of how these groups have been organizing in terms of like money is a big question for me, like how people even have the funding to sort of camp out for weeks and weeks. But one thing that I want to address as well is like this is just sort of one movement that spiraled from the convoy. You know, we have this Save the Children movement, but there's also Canadians for Truth. There's Take Back Alberta, which I don't think was as directly a spinoff of the convoy, but certainly contains a lot of the same people. So what sorts of groups are part of this post-Freedom Convoy? And like, to what extent is there, I guess, direct linkages between people having networked around the convoy, perhaps even like meeting in person on the Hill, and then these groups becoming increasingly organized afterwards?
Despite leaving Ottawa, we have continued to see a group, at least here in the city, of what's called the Wellington Street Regulars. It's a group of people who regularly are holding protests in front of Parliament Hill. It's anywhere between, you know, like a handful of people and upwards of 50. A lot of the people in that group are associated with the people that you saw at the Save the Children protest here in Ottawa in October that you mentioned, that we've seen at other events post-convoy. So, for example, the Rolling Thunder event that took place a couple April's ago.
The first night of the Rolling Thunder motorcycle rally has come to Ottawa and promises to be just as noisy as the truck convoy that preceded it. Police have said protesters on foot are welcome, but protest vehicles are not allowed within the exclusion zone where I'm standing right now.
A lot of this is hubbing around certain locations, to be sure. So at least from where I sit here in Ottawa, there's the Bikers Church, the Capital City Bikers Church, located in Vanier. This is a hub of people who attend the Freedom Convoy. And there's little pockets like this that exist sort of all over now. We saw a fundraiser in Swift Current for Chris Barber and Tamara Leach, two of the leaders of the convoy. Lots of people attended. They raised, I think, $35,000 in profit for that. So we are seeing sort of pockets of organization forming, and they are communicating and keeping in touch with one another.
Moskrup, you're sort of the more social movements type of guy. Like, how would you explain, I suppose, the shift in the movement and goals of the convoy? Because as you mentioned, it's not really just this thing that's tied to specific, you know, like vaccine mandates, like restrictions. If you think back to the winter of 2022, I think the protests were really galvanized in response to the fact that in a lot of places there were still restrictions on gatherings. There was the notion of like you needed to show your vaccine passport in order to access certain businesses and like, you know, basically elements of public life. That all has sort of faded into the background. I think we've like memory holed a lot of that. And now we're seeing, as you said, this response to like, you know, they're talking about taxation. They're talking about sex ed and gender ideology. They're talking about just these nebulous concepts of freedom, in some cases not really tied to any particular government policy. So I guess what is the linkage between these different political causes for these people?
Grievance politics. And it's not a new thing. You know, we might think, well, you know, people have stable ideologies and they're coherent and they walk around in their heads as little political philosophers, but the evidence suggests that's simply not true. People don't have consistent ideologies. They don't have particularly sophisticated ideologies as a rule. That's not to say people are stupid. It's to say that we don't walk around like little political philosophers. We do create community groups and social movements that create social bonds that become important to us, that can be motivated immediately by political concerns and grievances, that then kind of start to rebound on one another. And you might join this group because you're mad about the vaccine mandate, or because you're mad about taxes, or you think that the country's being overrun by X, Y, or Z. And then before you know it, now you're part of a social group and you have connections with that social group. You become a part of it and you feel good that you're a part of it. Now you start sharing ideas back and forth. And it might have started for one reason for one person, another reason for another, but before you know it, they're all mixed up together. The thread that I think runs through them all, there is a sense of grievance, and everyone gets to come to the party with their grievance. This is a particularly right-wing form of grievance politics. It also often takes the form of sort of toxic reactionary politics, occasionally even violent politics. And so that, again, nothing new about that. The new bit is the extent to which it's become networked and mobilized and funded. We mentioned funding. Cross-border funding. They raised a lot of money, not just in Canada, but through the United States as well. And once you get all that stood up, all of a sudden now you have a broader movement that's somewhat amorphous, but still powerful because it's become a social thing, not just a political thing.
I want to kind of dig more into this funding. I think it's interesting that you brought up the cross-border funding element, because there definitely is, I think, inflows of money from the U.S. into Canada. But it is also like a very, you know, a lot of these groups that have emanated from the Freedom Convoy movement are also very careful to paint themselves as being grassroots movements. And I think that is also to a large extent true. I remember during the peak Freedom Convoy, like January, February 2022, there was the release of like the Give, Send, Go donor data, like the list of people who had donated money to support the Freedom Convoy's continued sort of occupation of Wellington Street. And there were a lot of people that donated money who were just like regular people who supported the political ideals of the Freedom Convoy and felt represented and spoken for, I guess, by what was going on there. So I suppose to the extent that you guys are able to answer this question, I'm curious, like, how much money is coming from just like regular people who feel like this is a political movement that speaks to them versus how much of it is sort of like maybe more organized, networked, like what in the States often gets referred to as like dark money type funding. And how many people are really involved here? Because I think that there are some people that are really like diehard true believers that are at the crux of this movement that are involved in multiple organizations. But it also seems like there are a lot of just like regular people who are not generally that politically engaged, who Moskrop, as you said, are not. And thank God that most people don't do this. They're not walking around like little political philosophers. I guess, like, what's your read on like the overall financial and also just like people power of these movements?
I would say right off the hop that we know, for example, in the case of Tamara Leach and Chris Barber, they're well supported by libertarian organizations like the Democracy Fund, that's Conrad Black, JCCF, the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. So there is a bit of that in terms of, you know, big, big money players. But I can also say, spending time around Tamara Leach and Chris Barber, it is remarkable the amount of people who will just walk up to them and hand them money. I've seen with my own eyes standing there, people walk up to both of them and give them hundreds of dollars.
The groups part is so important, that they're institutionally funded from groups on both sides of the border. I'm talking about the movement in general. And if you go back to the convoy occupation itself, I mean, there were 100,000 donors or something like that, right? If you go, the Intercept reported on this at the time, it was something like 104,000 donors is the number they cited. So obviously that's not all institutions, it's not all American billionaires. There's a lot of day-to-day folks that are funding this.
This episode is brought to you by AG1. Now that spring is very much in the air, the birds are chirping, there's been some days where I can sit out on my porch, I can even start to dream about what the summer is going to be like. But honestly, this winter was not that bad for me, because this year I've really been trying to take care of myself and do what's right for my body. AG1 is a big part of that. It helps me get in all my nutrients and vitamins and just makes me feel good. Plus, I can top off a glass of AG1 with a drop or two of vitamin D3 and K2, and I'm good to go. They are committed to making sure you're getting a really safe product, and that what's on the label is actually what you're getting. Try AG1 now, and you'll get a free welcome kit that includes a shaker bottle, canister, and metal scoop, along with 5 free travel packs and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2, all with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/backbench. That's drinkag1.com/backbench. Check it out. I'm curious, I guess, just to dive a little bit more into this question of grievance politics, right? Because I think you've both mentioned that this notion of like anti-establishment energy and feeling, grievance politics, isn't something that originated with the convoy, but that the convoy was rather like a manifestation of that, that I think has spawned now all of these sort of splinter groups or spin-off groups, really activated, I think, an energy that was like already latent in a lot of folks. So I guess, to what extent can we attribute, you know, this movement to just the specific conditions of COVID, right? Because a lot of it was the sort of government lockdown conspiracy stuff, or like genuine concerns about the way that stay-at-home orders were being implemented and like the way that police were being given powers that maybe people felt they shouldn't have. How much of it was just that, and how much of it was maybe like pre-existing grievances that got activated by that specific moment of like COVID?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, lazy or reductive to just paint the whole convoy as a racist, hateful group. You know, like, overwhelmingly, if you talk to people who were at the protests then and who are still involved with the movement now, they're hurting. Like, that's the biggest thing that comes across. These are people, a lot of them, who they lost their jobs, like a lot of us, of course, during the pandemic. They couldn't visit their loved ones at the hospital. They were dealing with mental health issues. There's a bit of a class issue here. A lot of the people that I talked to, they didn't own credit cards. They couldn't shop online. They didn't have backyards or balconies that they could enjoy. They lived in rural areas where public health measures maybe didn't make much sense to them. When you look at, again, going back to Chris Barber, this is a guy who was going back and forth between the United States and Canada through his job as a trucker. He's seeing the differences in pandemic policies. He lives on a property where the closest place to him is his parents. They're 5 minutes down the road. You can see how it could be frustrating for him. People who worked long hours during the pandemic, who were really like pushed to their limit. So we do see that still. As we've talked about, it's manifested itself in a lot of different ways. A lot of this is steeped in sort of this protective feeling of moral authority or righteousness for whatever reason. I think the evangelical right plays a pretty significant role in all of this. And again, we talked about this a little bit, but I think the pandemic really did accelerate this, you know, challenging the status quo consensus narrative. We saw, you know, the rise of Donald Trump. He helps give this newfound permission for people to do so. You mix in the economic hardship, disconnect from central powers, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's all sort of baked into the pie of what we see now.
That's such an important point. I mean, the class point, I think, is largely missed in Canada, in no small part because we are so bad at talking about class. And I mean, Matei, you and I talked about this at length a little while ago. We talked about the state of the left, you recall. The left has abandoned, in large part, a lot of these folks who are then scooped up by right-wing movements who are more than happy to have them. And what could have been a productive class politics discussion about oppression and those who make the stuff and those who profit off of those who make the stuff turned into something much, much nastier. Not that there aren't xenophobes and transphobes and anti-gay folks, there are, but as David Fraser mentions, it's not the whole story. And if you go back to answer the initial question, go back to 2017, 2018 in the Yellow Vest movement, that was a precursor to the convoy.
The convoy is part of the larger Canadian Yellow Vest movement. Every weekend in communities across Canada, there are protests like this, even in minus 30, those so committed to their cause.
It was ostensibly about carbon taxes. This is what they kind of launched the initial Facebook group about. But obviously, it wasn't how it ultimately manifested. It became extremely and expressly xenophobic. The Canadian iteration, the French iteration was something different. But again, class also pervaded the movement inside of that too. So it is a complex thing we need to unpack, but it definitely pre-existed the pandemic because it was already very, very visibly present in 2017, 2018. In a sense, Matei, you mentioned latent, which made me think of Lenin. You know, the power was just sort of lying there in the streets. I bring this up all the time, despite being avowedly not a Leninist, but the power was in the streets. It had been there for a long time, and people came by and scooped it up.
And just a quick point on the Yellow Vests movement, much of the leadership of the Freedom Convoy movement was integral to the Yellow Vest movement back in 2017 and through to 2019 there.
Yeah, I was really, really glad to hear you bring up Yellow Vest, because when we were talking kind of as a production team about what some of the precursors had been to the convoy and what were sort of the largest, I guess, like big mass protests on Parliament Hill in recent years, that was the immediate thing I thought of. And a lot of the grievances seemed very similar. I think it's a good note that not only was there sort of existing, I guess, organizational capacity on the part of people who could actually organize protests and get people, you know, to Ottawa, but I suppose, like, you're also mentioning Facebook groups and sort of social networks of people that are maybe more casually invested in these movements. You know, if I go poking around, I see, you know, if I want to look for these groups where like-minded people congregate, you can find many, many Facebook groups where there are thousands and thousands of people who are members. To what extent is that, like, a significant part of what's going on? And how much stock, I guess, should we put in the amount of people that like particular causes, follow particular causes on social media? Like, to what extent does that translate into, like, real life organizing and political action?
I think it sort of depends on the group, depends who's behind it. But without doubt, those social media connections are playing a significant role, if by doing nothing else than keeping the conversation going, keeping a little bit of momentum behind these movements taking place. We've seen a couple failed efforts to sort of recreate the convoy. Most of those efforts percolated online first, some backroom organizing, but a lot of it percolates in those Facebook groups and other sites that you see. The role of sites like Rumble and Facebook Lives have also become really significant. Of course, during the convoy, there's a few streamers who were kind of like must watch for the people who were following along for the convoy. They've still continued to be must watch for supporters of the movement.
Well, specifically on the fact that the technology, as I suggested earlier, has become the defining characteristic. I mean, it is the in many ways the sine qua non of the whole thing. When we talk about YouTube, for instance, I mean, YouTube was a major space of radicalization for people for a long time, and there was concerns that, well, the algorithm, you start the algorithm because you're angry about something, and before you know it, you're down this rabbit hole that is further radicalizing you and connecting you with people who are deeply radicalized. And now you're starting to come up with this theory of the world that has been checked against nothing but the communities that are predisposed to support these messages already. And then down the rabbit hole you go, and then all of a sudden you're into a filter bubble or an echo chamber. And there's good research on echo chambers and filter bubbles. Elizabeth Dubois at the University of Ottawa has done work on this and says they're exaggerated. The extent to which this is the problem is exaggerated. It's not like literally every person in the world is down this into these echo chambers, but people do get sucked into them. And the question I always pose is, how many people do you think it takes to cause a significant disruption in this country? And it's much smaller than you think. Remember when land defenders were blockading parts of the country, when the conflict in Wet'suwet'en was going down, when folks were blockading the rail? I happen to think that was a righteous and just movement. I supported it. But there was a fairly small number of people who were causing, again, a righteous ruckus is what I'd call it. It doesn't take 30% of the country, 40% of the country. It takes a mobilized minority who are willing to put things on the line for good reason or bad, and certainly they're going to think it's a good reason, or to become violent in public, to drive a van into a family, for instance, right? Like a very small number of people can cause a great deal of damage. And when you get a significant number of people, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions who are going down these rabbit holes, the probability of something like that happening goes way, way, way up. That's why we have to take it very, very seriously. And again, this then loops around to thinking about how we're going to regulate or manage the technologies we now face, the platform technologies and the messaging technologies, not just from a technical perspective, but from a social perspective of the fact that we're constantly all part of a society in which we're sort of raising each other, right? And socializing each other. And we haven't wrapped our heads around the tech bit, and we certainly haven't wrapped our heads around the sociological bit. And I'm not seeing any governments I trust to do it particularly well right now. So I'm not particularly bullish on the future of this stuff in the near term.
If I could, I thought of a tangible example of the significance and perhaps the role that social media and fundraising is continuing to play. Pat King, one of the Freedom Convoy organizers who's facing criminal charges, he successfully had his bail varied to allow him to make videos online for Facebook Live so that he could fundraise. It's, you know, he says in each of those videos specifically for fundraising purposes, people are sending e-transfers to his lawyer. We don't know what the amount is. Maybe we'll learn at a future court date, but just from looking at those comments and then the people pledging it, it seems like it's not an insignificant amount.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by AG1. Now that spring is very much in the air, the birds are chirping, there's been some days where I can sit out on my porch, I can even start to dream about what the summer is going to be like. But honestly, this winter was not that bad for me because this year I've really been trying to take care of myself and do what's right for my body. AG1 is a big part of that. It helps me get in all my nutrients and vitamins and just makes me feel good. Plus, I can top off a glass of AG1 with a drop or two of vitamin D3 and K2, and I'm good to go. They are committed to making sure you're getting a really safe product and that what's on the label is actually what you're getting. Try AG1 now, and you'll get a free welcome kit that includes a shaker bottle, canister, and metal scoop, along with 5 free travel packs and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2, all with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/backbench. That's drinkag1.com/backbench. Check it out. This episode is also brought to you by Douglas. There's nothing like waking up from a good night's sleep. Your bedroom was the perfect temperature, your sheets were crisp and fresh, your blanket was the perfect thickness. All that's left for you to do is look into your old dream interpretation book from like 1972 and try and figure out why exactly you were dreaming about playing rec soccer with people that you've never played soccer with before. You only know them from that television game show you had to do one time. But of course, to have that deep sleep where you're having wild and wacky dreams that require interpretation, you need to have the perfect mattress. Like my mattress, the Douglas. It's got the perfect amount of firmness, and it's got a layer of EcoLite cooling gel. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress protector, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/CanadaLand. So this is such a perfect pivot because I actually wanted to move to talking about some of the major trials of convoy organizers that are going on, including Pat King. So I guess the three big ones that I've seen covered in media, but honestly, I'm going to admit, like, I've not done as good of a job as probably I should have of following these. We're seeing Pat King's trials ongoing, Tamara Leach and Chris Barber. So I guess first things first, if we can maybe sort of clarify, these trials are going on. What are these people actually on trial for? You know, what about outside of those major trials? You know, are there other people that have faced charges? Has anyone actually been found guilty? I think that at the time of the convoy sort of being moved out of Ottawa, there was a lot of police action just to clear people out of the area.
The Coles Notes catch up here, I suppose, is, as you say, several of the organizers making their way through courts. Tamara Leach, Chris Barber, they're facing mischief, intimidation, and a bunch of counseling charges, so counseling to commit mischief, et cetera, et cetera. Their trial started way back in September. It's really been bogged down by delays, limited court availability, things like this. We're now closer to the end than the finish on that one. They're arguing over how specific pieces of evidence are going to be used. We're expecting closing to come up in August, and then within 6 months, a decision on that one. Pat King, another one of the leaders who everybody's kind of looking to that trial, he's set to begin in May, facing very similar charges. So mischief, counseling to commit mischief, intimidation, et cetera, et cetera. Those are sort of the big ones that everybody's paying attention to right now. You mentioned during the convoy and when the police initiated their action to clear the streets, they arrested about 230 people, something like that, I think. Of those, there was a little over 100 arrests. Without doubt, some of those people have been prosecuted, found guilty. We've also seen a lot of charges from the Crown being withdrawn. Nobody is doing a good enough job paying attention to those lesser files. I think for Ottawa residents, there's a lot of accountability looked to in terms of what's going to happen with those accused. And I do hope that we find some sort of closing from whether it's the Ottawa police or the feds or the courts, or somebody gives us some sense of what's going on in terms of that accountability once it's all said and done. Because, of course, a lot of these trials are still in the mix.
So I know, Fraser, you've been doing like local reporting and have been present sort of in courtrooms, around the courtrooms. I know you mentioned earlier you've seen people like handing out money to the folks on trial, their supporters, and there's sort of this like, I guess, continued galvanization around these court cases. What has the vibe been like in and around the courtroom? What is the vibe like there? Can I get a vibe check on these trials?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So on any given day, there's a group of supporters there for the trial. When Tamara Leach and Chris Barber are on trial, there's, you know, anywhere between like 5 and 25 people gathered inside and outside the courtroom. A lot of them like to sort of go back and forth from standing outside the courthouse with signs that say, you know, liberty, freedom, free Tamara, things like this. They often have a boombox and they just kind of hang out there. And then inside the courtroom, I wouldn't say the courtroom is full, but every row has people in it, and it is in one of the larger courtrooms in Ottawa. Most of the people there are supporters of Chris and Tamara, so Barber and Leach will sit sort of directly behind their lawyers. They often have, like, Tamara Leach often brings her husband with her. Barber has at times had one of his kids or his wife with him. And then behind them is, you know, full rows of supporters. And in between breaks, there's a lot of people that just come up to them. As I said, I've seen lots of people just coming up to Tamara or Chris saying thank you, handing them money. One time I saw somebody give like a custom-made guitar to Tamara. So it is a little bit of a feeling of that like extension of the convoy by being around there. And it's a lot of the same people, honestly. So at this point, they know me, I know them. And so there is a bit of a rapport amongst kind of everybody that goes into the courtroom, because we've been doing it for, you know, nearing 50 days at this point. So everybody's getting to know each other a little bit.
You know, a big part of the conversation that I think, again, has been kind of memory hold is the whole, you know, Emergencies Act being implemented and the subsequent inquiry. And the ruling, as I understand it, that came out was that it was understandable that the government implemented it, but that ultimately it was overreach and not justified. Has there been any sort of like response among the convoy movement or the what remains of the convoy movement more broadly to the Emergencies Act inquiry to these court cases ongoing? Like, is there sort of a feeling at all that this is a continued manifestation of government overreach? Like, what's the feeling there, would you say?
Yeah, so I think without doubt the federal court decision that found portions of the use of the Emergencies Act to be not constitutional really galvanized a lot of the people involved in the movement. I just happened to be with quite a few, you know, people that are pretty entrenched in the freedom movement, doing interviews with them when that news came down. And the group that I was with, they felt incredibly inspired and galvanized by that. We saw that reflected in the number of people who showed up for their sort of weekly big protest that they do each Friday in front of the Hill. It notably had not a significant amount of people still, you know, probably less than 100, but more than they would usually have out. A lot of them with signs directly related to that federal court decision. People are really hanging on to those, you know, quote unquote wins that they can get within the freedom movement when they can. When we look at things like the trial of Barber and Leach, I think a lot will turn on that. I think a lot of people will look at this as, you know, do we have a corrupt court system or do we have a fair and just court system? That's how a lot of the supporters of them are going to be viewing this, I think.
Moskarp, I see you nodding. Do you have anything you want to add, or are you just nodding as like a...
No, I agree. And I was just thinking, the Emergencies Act should have never been necessary. I mean, I think we're now looking back on it with the benefit of distance. At the time, I mean, I lived down the road. They were on the Parliament Hill. I was at Gig in Dalhousie, which is not a couple of minutes walk from Parliament. I was at the, in fact, when the class action suit was launched, I was just, I think it was something like one street east of the boundary, but it was chaos and it disrupted all kinds of lives. But we forget how poorly this thing was managed at the municipal, provincial, and also federal level, that the Emergencies Act, for all its flaws and for all of the admittedly problematic invocation of it, for some elements anyway, it should have never come to that, because we were failed at so many levels, which raised questions not just about the movement itself that was able to establish themselves and occupy a good chunk of the city, but the failures of government at multiple levels.
I think it feels like a weird omission to not at least talk about sort of what the lingering, effect of that whole thing has been. Because I think one thing that's been interesting, I suppose, to see is like the way that the Conservative Party, and particularly like in the, you know, Poiliev incarnation of the Conservative Party, the way that they've kind of latched on to maybe not some of the actual organizations that have come out of convoy politics, but some of the language, I think, that the post-convoy movements use also gets echoed by certain Conservative members of Parliament. Pierre Poiliev was campaigning for the leadership at the time that the convoy was set up in Ottawa, and he was actually out meeting people there. That was something that got a lot of media play at the time that people criticized him for, but that I think perhaps actually like really benefited him when it came to winning the leadership. There was this sort of perception of him as like being a man of the people, and he's really actually out there talking to folks who have these grievances with the government. So I'll turn to Moskrip first, but I want to hear from both of you on this. What do you see as the relationship between the Conservative Party and these post-convoy movements right now?
I mean, it's a Faustian bargain. You can clip and save this. At some point, Pierre Poiliev and the CPC are going to get themselves bitten right on the ass by this. And maybe not in the way you think. They're going to win, I'm assuming. And let's call it in the fall of 2025, once everyone's pensions are secured, they're going to win. And then they're going to have to govern. And that's going to mean compromise. And that's going to mean having to turn their back on these folks in ways that are going to really anger. I think they're going to face a backlash. But right now, they're trying to walk a very fine line between identifying with and mobilizing the frustrations and pain and genuine grievances of these folks, and to mobilize them and their support without outright supporting the more fringe, xenophobic, toxic elements of that movement. It's going to be a very, very fine line to walk. And it's a fine line that's been that the CPC has been walking pretty much since the Harper years, at least the contemporary iteration of the Conservatives. They've been walking this line very closely. And if you recall, you know, so Stephen Harper, to his credit, I'm going to risk the drill tweet here, but I'm going to do his credit. You got to give it up for Stephen Harper, who recognized that he had to restrain the more problematic elements of his party if he ever wanted to win. We call that the civilizing force of hypocrisy, you know? And you notice that they were very loath to touch abortion, right? They didn't want to fight on same-sex marriage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because they didn't want to mobilize the toxic and backlash currents that were within the party. It's going to be the same thing this time. And it's very easy when you're in opposition to run your mouth and to go and shake hands. But then you got to make decisions. And I think it's going to be real tough for them to strike that balance.
Yeah, I think those are all a good point. And I think it's increasingly clear that there is this pressure on traditional right-wing parties to cater to this demographic. We can see that in real ways, the election of Danielle Smith and the policies that she's introduced since. We can see what's going on in Saskatchewan, particularly Premier Scott Moe's reaction to the rise of a not just one, but two right-wing parties in that province. There was a particular by-election where they were a by-election in rural Saskatchewan where they were threatened a lot more than I think they expected to be. It wasn't long after that we saw Scott Moe introduce his pronoun policy in schools there. So it's something that's being courted. It makes sense that it would be. We talked about the amount of money that's involved here earlier. It is an astounding amount of money to have a protest movement have, you know, $20 million pledged or donated to them. That's the type of figures that we saw during the Freedom Convoy. No political parties in Canada are raising that amount of money in that amount of time. So it does make sense that it's being courted. I know that there's people within the leadership movement of the Freedom Convoy who maintain at least some relations with their members of parliament and their MLAs out west. There is connections there. There is talk back and forth.
Yeah, I think it's good that you brought up these examples of where this sort of thing has happened in the provinces, because the immediate thing that I thought of was the sort of Take Back Alberta movement and the fact that, you know, there's obviously a certain percentage of the voter base in Alberta of people that are politically engaged that are just like never really going to engage with conservative politics there whatsoever. And so perhaps the way that these political movements are able to exert influence is kind of within the Conservative Party, knowing that especially in Alberta or Saskatchewan, a Conservative Party has a really strong chance of forming government, trying to push those parties to the right as much as possible. And I think that that's what we kind of saw with like the ouster of Jason Kenney, which was largely orchestrated and supported by Take Back Alberta, that they perceived him as having compromised too much, moved too far to the center, need to get rid of this guy and replace him. Is that sort of the type of dynamic that you guys see perhaps maybe happening within the Federal Conservative Party in the future with these groups as they become increasingly entrenched and organized?
I think so. I mean, it, to some extent, already has happened with the PPC and Maxime Bernier, just they haven't been runaway successful, although if getting 4, 5, 6% is not nothing, right? I mean, in some cases more in some ridings. I mean, because of our first past the post system, we say, oh well, look, you know, these bozos aren't ending up in parliament. That's only because their support isn't concentrated in a particular area, which it would have to be in order to deliver seats under first past the post. 6% of people supporting the PPC is quite high. That's a lot of people. And it indicates that there is a serious vein of that sort of backlash, discontent-based politics that's there. People often say there's this myth that the left is the fractious section of Canadian institutional politics at the federal level. But that's not historically true. It's the right. It's the right that routinely falls apart and fights with internally, right? The 1980s saw the rise of Reform and the decline of the progressive conservatives. The 90s saw the wild fracturing of the right. That's what allowed the Chrétien government to dominate parliament as long as it did and return big majorities. They got their shit together in the 2000s and united, but those currents are still there. And there's been a long-standing fight to kind of damp down the red Tory, the kind of progressive conservatives within the movement, and to push them somewhere else. And you see some, like, you know, what is it called? Center ice pops up as an attempt to get over this, but it's kind of, nobody pays attention to it. But those battles are still there. And now the right is facing, again, internally, an even further splintering, but it's of the right and the, like, the proper right and the even farther right. But electorally, the Tories still have to say to themselves, well, if we want to win, we can't be too extreme. We want to win the suburbs of Toronto, the suburbs of Vancouver. We need the 905. So we got to play kind of tight. while also facing a kind of facing this electoral pressure and policy pressure on the right. And Polyev is smack dab in the middle of this. And if you look at the conservative policy convention that just went through, and they endorsed some pretty far stuff, especially on trans rights, that's an indication of that, that at the grassroots level, there's a lot of pressure coming from the farther right end of the party. And I do think that's going to risk fracturing the party in the years to come once they form government, because people aren't going to be satisfied anymore with just proclamations or promises. They're going to want to see action. Now, whether that leads to another party altogether or to more people defecting to the PPC or so on, that remains to be seen. But I do think it's going to lead to a further fracture of the right in the long run.
I think the Take Back Alberta model is one that a lot of people look to as something that has worked. I know that it's trying to be replicated right now in Saskatchewan, and by all accounts, it seems to be working pretty well. There's real efforts. And I know in Saskatchewan and Alberta, at least to my eye, it looks like it's being organized by a sort of a core group of people provincially. In Ontario, what I'm seeing is sort of pockets, you know, so Thunder Bay has people doing this, Sarnia has people doing this, et cetera, and less of a sort of a cross Ontario effort. But what it is it's an effort to encourage people to run for your local school board, run for local health boards, challenge nomination meetings for the Conservatives and PPCs. We should expect to see those nomination meetings. I expect we'll see a lot of really contested ones. I was talking to somebody in Saskatchewan a couple of weeks ago, and if you're a Saskatchewan party, that the Conservative Party in Saskatchewan provincially, and you're from a rural riding, you're always way more concerned about your nomination than you are about your actual election, because the nomination is where the real competition is. I think places like that is where we're really, really going to see that splintering, that pressure from the as Moskrop says, the farther right of the party. We've already seen it manifest in entirely new parties, but once we get into proper election season here, I think we're really going to see more of that.
Yeah, I guess like the sort of follow-up question I have to all of this is I want to, I guess, maybe pick up on this thing that you mentioned of like we're seeing this discourse like trickle down into nominations and that's maybe where we're seeing some of these fractures emerge. Also seeing it in elections that are not necessarily partisan elections, like the school boards thing is huge. I remember in the last Toronto municipal election when I was trying to like figure out who to vote for school board, and like I don't have children, I don't really pay attention at all to what the TDSB does. But I did look at the websites of each of the candidates in my ward, and seeing the sort of like coded dog whistly language that was showing up again in like a downtown Toronto, like very progressive riding, that we saw this stuff about protecting our children, about maintaining, you know, let kids be kids, which often means let them not find out about gay people. Like that sort of thing, I think, seems to be trickling into a lot of, I guess, like lower level politics outside of the federal realm. So I suppose, like, you know, how do you guys see this shaping discourse, I guess, like outside of conservative politics? So I know there's been some mentions of like grievance politics isn't the exclusive provenance of the right, that a lot of the issues that are being talked about are sort of universal issues like class issues, concerns about state overreach, whatever. Like, I kind of feel like this whole movement has the potential to shift like not just how the right engages politically, but also how the center and left are engaged.
A couple of thoughts there. One is, you know, on the point of things like school boards, these have become something that, you know, as a local newsroom in CBC Ottawa, we wouldn't pay much attention to now they're almost like much must watch, must cover events. And part of that is because of what we see in this sort of anti-trans efforts and protests that are arising from it. What's interesting about those school board meetings and protests and other things that we're seeing is as much as there are people there, you know, trying to insert this anti-trans agenda and other things into school boards and other places, there's always a counter protest there. It's usually much more sizable. One thing that I've observed again here in Ottawa is we talked earlier about this community that's formed out of the Freedom Convoy. In that exact same sense, there's a community of people that have formed counter-protesting the freedom movement. They're still galvanized, still active, and now what they're doing is they're showing up at school board meetings to counter the anti-trans protests. That's something that I find really interesting.
So, you know that old bit that Canada is sort of 10 years behind the United States? In this instance, we may be several decades behind, but we could be trending in a direction that's very familiar to the U.S. If you go back to the 1950s and 60s in the U.S., the American Political Science Association comes out in the 1950s and says, we have a crisis in this country. We aren't polarized enough. No joke. I mean, imagine, you know, 75 years on, we'd think we should be so lucky, but there was a problem. Is it because they said in the post-war era in the United States, liberals are liberal, Democrats are liberal, Republicans also liberal. And there was a group of American conservatives who did not like this. They wanted political polarization. And there was a deliberate project in the 60s, 70s to polarize the country so that Republicans would become conservative and offer a different view of the country, a different vision. They start targeting every aspect of American politics and society, right? From the school boards on up, from some down ballot races at the state level, the municipal level, the federal level, then the courts and so on and so forth. And we see what has come of that, right? And there's a movement in Canada to do something similar from the school boards on up. That's significant. So there is a movement right now, a culture war based movement, struggle over the future of the state. And that's going to be a big fight for years to come. And the outcomes are going to matter a great deal from, as Fraser mentioned, from the nomination ridings and the school boards on up, all the way up. And it's very easy to miss that stuff for all kinds of reasons, especially as media is, you know, consistently struggling to try to cover everything because of resource issues. But it's going to be there, and we ought to keep a close eye on it.
Well, perfect segue into the last thing I wanted to ask you folks before we wrap. We kind of haven't seen a ton of media coverage of, you know, the convoy, of these movements that have come out of it. There's obviously some folks, you know, Fraser, like you, that are doing reporting on these trials. But, you know, our media ecosystem, as famously we all know in Canada, is just like shriveling and withering away. It's really quite distressing, and it feels harder than ever to keep a close eye on these things that matter. So just as a final thought, is there anything that you think is really being missed in the discussions that we're having about this? Like, for our listeners, what should they be paying attention to and looking out for in the coming months? And especially as we, I guess, barrel towards the 2025 probably election?
I think one thing that's consistently missed is painting the Freedom Convoy itself, like the actual events in 2022 and what's come out of it since with a monolithic brush. It is fairly diverse, but of course at the heart of a lot of what we're seeing in the freedom movement now is this, you know, longing to return to a quote-unquote true Christian nation. And in that, there's, you know, men only marrying women, only two genders, etc., etc. That's something that's going to continue to be at the core of this, I think.
Class. We are very bad in this country at talking about class, at wrapping our heads around it. Political class doesn't want to talk about it. Only a handful in the media class want to talk about it and are able to talk about it. But it's going to be central, is central, is going to continue to be central to everything we do. And there's always going to be xenophobic, anti-gay, racist folks. And they're always going to be a problem in and of themselves. But there's also a group of people who are in the middle who are susceptible to this messaging for class-based reasons, for economic material reasons, who are getting picked off one by one. And the center and the left who should know better, have no structural program to woo them back or to prevent them from being suckered into the far-right movement. And we've got to get our shit together on that because we're playing for keeps here.
Thank you so much to both of you for a really engaging conversation. I was not necessarily looking forward to taking a trip back memory lane to thinking about the convoy. So thanks for helping me make sense of this. Yeah, I had a great time chatting with both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
I would say I definitely fall into the category of people who have just kind of like memory holed a lot of the really bad aspects of COVID. I'm somebody who just due to circumstance ended up being super lucky through the whole thing. I was able to work. I was stuck in a pretty small apartment, but I didn't have children in the apartment with me that I had to care for. I didn't have to miss major life events like weddings, funerals, things that really required me to be together with other people. The worst thing that I really experienced was I didn't get to have university convocation, which, like, who gives a shit? And I think it's important to look back now that we've all sort of had this collective amnesia about COVID and remember, like, how difficult it really was and why it was that people felt like they were pushed to a bit of a breaking point, such that some people were willing to trek all the way across the country to go set up an encampment essentially in Ottawa with bouncy castles and propane tanks and bring their children with them. I think about people who were out of work for months and months, who were having to subsist on CERB, which was better than nothing, but not really necessarily what they would have gotten in their regular job. I think about people who lost loved ones, either due to COVID or just like regular, you know, death that happens in life, and weren't able to visit those loved ones in the hospital, weren't able to hold funerals. I think about people who, you know, were vaccine hesitant, and then because of the sort of anxiety around public health, were in many cases like demonized by the media and talked down to in a way that they found very alienating. There were a lot of experiences that were like very real, very difficult. It was not a good time, even though I was kind of vibing and like, you know, working from home and smoking weed in the evenings with my friends. My experience was highly anomalous. And so I think it's important as we look at these post-convoy movements to approach them from a sense of understanding that although there is some kind of cuckoo conspiracy stuff that's going on, particularly with people that are, you know, making these insinuations about they're turning the kids trans in schools, making insinuations about Justin Trudeau is trying to establish a police state, there are also a lot of people who simply saw that there was police overreach during parts of the pandemic and thought, I don't feel good about this. People who felt frustrated at the sort of fact that there was no real rhyme or reason to the way that pandemic restrictions were applied. Like, why was there a curfew in Quebec? Did it do anything? Was it good? I think in hindsight, we can sort of identify that maybe that was overreach. And so I think that as we move forward, we need to really look at, like, there are a lot of people who were politically galvanized by this movement, by that period of time, who are now being drawn to a wide swath of political movements, some of which are, I think, like, legitimate and we need to engage with, others of which are nuts. I think we can see that a lot of the language around, like, gatekeepers that we see the Conservative Party using is stuff that, like, very much comes out of this kind of convoy and freedom ethos. And it's something that we need to be able to grapple with if we are outside of that movement, to be able to understand why people feel this way. I don't think it will really do us any good, you know, if we come from the center or the left to just sort of try and ignore this and hope it will go away. It's something that needs to be engaged with. And, you know, I think we need to be able to sort of separate the people who have real grievances that need to be addressed. I think it was really great that we had a discussion about class-based grievances and class-based differences. That's something that politicians in Canada really haven't talked about. To sort of separate that from the really insidious, reactionary, transphobic, homophobic, racist, and anti-immigrant politics that we see a lot of people getting swept into. We need to reach people before they sort of fall off the deep end. And that doesn't happen if we sort of demonize and paint all of the people who are drawn to these movements with a broad brush. All right, let's adjourn. That's been The Backbench. We'll talk again soon. The Backbench is actually going on a short break, so we'll see you in late April. Let us know what you're pissed off about, what you've been watching closely, and what you want to hear us discuss in the world of Canadian politics. Send us your questions, your concerns, and your rants. You can email us at backbench@candleland.com, and you can also DM us on Twitter at backbenchcast. I'm Matea Roach, and you can find me at Matea Roach on Twitter and Instagram. You can find David Mosscrop on Twitter at David_Mosscrop, and you can find David Fraser at DC Fraser. The first Canadian automobile was a steam buggy built by Henry Seth Taylor in 1867, which is like way earlier than I thought anybody was making cars in Canada. Taylor was a watchmaker and jeweler in Stansted, Quebec. This automobile was unveiled at the Stansted Fall Fair that year, and the vehicle was crashed into a creek shortly thereafter. This episode was produced by Aviva Lassard and Sam Connert, with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production coordinator is Andre Prue. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by Nathan Burley. Hey, why not celebrate the coming of spring with free Canada-wide shipping from the Candleland store? There's breezy tees and dad caps for those sunny days that we're hopefully going to be seeing soon. And also cozy toques, long sleeves, and hoodies for those other days, like the one we're having on the day of recording, where it is snowing even though it's spring. Gross. Enter the discount code SPRING24 at checkout to get free Canada-wide shipping. Discount codes are set to combine, so if you support Candleland through Patreon or Supercast, be sure to use your supporter discount as well for major spring savings. Free Canada-wide shipping runs until March 31st at midnight Eastern Time. Extra bonus? A portion of each sale is donated to Journalists for Human Rights in support of its Canadian programs. Duly toted. If you value this podcast, support us. You'll get premium access to all our shows ad-free, including early releases and bonus content, plus discounts on that merch that could be shipped to you for free. Head to candleland.com/join to become a supporter. You can listen ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Thank you for listening. This episode is also brought to you by Douglas. I used to not be a morning person. I used to need one of those blaring alarms to get me out of bed. But now I wake up refreshed and rested thanks to my Douglas mattress. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress protector, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/CanadaLand.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.